This podcast exists to learn about the love, the dignity, and the creative power of Black people who are our fellow Americans. And this podcast exists to value differences while breaking down conscious and unconscious barriers of separation, which are sometimes caused by those differences. In this October episode, I am scary grateful and supremely honored to be sharing conversation with Freddie Taylor, the founder and CEO of Sankofa Club, an online resource for Black parents to supplement their children's education and, in Freddie's words, to keep the miseducation away. Miseducation? Oh, yes. Plenty of miseducation about Black people's history, and the time is long overdue for real-world facts to be acknowledged and affirmed, because the facts about Black people's history and legacy extend far beyond the cruel and dehumanizing chapter of their enslavement in this country. Because 1 month each year is just not enough, not even close. Freddie Taylor is dedicated, in the best sense of that word, to providing well-researched facts about Black people's creative contributions, courage, and leadership for today's Black children. Because today's Black children deserve to grow up with pride in the true worth of their community, their culture, their ancestors. I've watched hours of Freddie's online offerings, and the number one impression for me has been the deep rightness of his motivations, his intentions, his service mindset, and all of that with uncommon generosity and positive energy. Welcome to the One White Woman podcast. My name is Nene White, and with a heart full of respectful appreciation, I dedicate this episode to Freddie's father, for reasons that will become obvious throughout this conversation. Freddie Taylor, thank you. Thank you for having conversation with me again. I'm just almost ecstatic would be the right word to say how much I appreciate you taking the time for this. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I don't think you can possibly imagine how much I respect and admire what you're up to, but I just saw on Facebook today that you were posting that your dad had recently let you know how proud he is of what you're doing.
Oh, yes, you saw that.
I did. And do you want to share anything about that? I just know that you kind of resisted his encouragements in certain ways when you were a kid. So what an
right.
Experience. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't even know where, that's so fresh. I don't even know where to start with that. But I'll just start with, I shared with him the Black Fridays, one of the Black Fridays episodes. So we're doing an 8-week series that we call Black Fridays, where we bring Black history and empowerment to our community, right? So it's basically a 30-minute segment where I'm pontificating about some particular aspect of history that has me quite fascinated at the moment. And I was just trying to make sure that Dad was plugged in to the conversation and what I was doing. So I emailed him, or I texted him the link to the Black Friday episode where I did on Haiti, the Haitian Revolution. Yeah. And, you know, so he watches the episode and he called me, and you could just hear the pride. So he was just so excited and proud about what I'm doing. And he loved that episode and everything else that we're doing here with Urban Intellectuals. I heard him say, this was awesome to me. I didn't even share this in my post, but I heard him say, I finally got a platform, you know, and not me, not Freddie the second, which I'm the second, I'm his namesake. But he said, I have a platform. Like, it's him talking, because he hears his words and his thoughts through me, which, you know, I've just really been sucking up his knowledge and information and insight and perspective over the years. So I don't know, I smile and I beam with pride over that, because that's my man. He's the one that introduced me to Black history, and, you know, knowing and honoring our history and our heritage, and was beating into my head why it's so important that we knew all of that. And, you know, you alluded to, I didn't really pay attention. I didn't. I was just a typical child who didn't want to hear and learn about history. Right. I just wanted to be a child, you know, and grow up and all of that. But as I got into college, I guess we'll go into that a little bit later. I kind of came back to Black history and its importance. But it was just really a rewarding experience to hear Dad, who I love and respect so much, talk so fondly of like my passion.
Right. And I think that the reason that I started with that, because as a parent and as parents who are listening will really feel encouraged by the fact, the lived fact that you're having and your dad is having and I've certainly been having in my life, is that even though we can be talking to our kids and it seems like they just don't want to hear a syllable from us, if we're solid in what we know is right and good for them, and we keep on in a loving way, you know, that's not horrible and haranguing, but just we're solid in what we know is valuable for them, it goes in and it just goes, it's like planting a seed that you don't know when it's going to come up. But I don't, what are your thoughts on that? That's just why I'm so excited to start with this.
That was great way to wrap that in. But you started talking about making sure that you're putting that message in. I grew up like three or four houses down from the Bibles, the kids' Bible study that I used to attend every summer, Miss Burrell's Bible study. And wow, I haven't told about any of that in so long. That's weird. It just popped up. But she used to talk about putting the word into the brains of children as seeds. So you're planting seeds in their minds and you're not really sure when it's going to germinate, but that seed is in there. So yeah, I would love to push and encourage parents to, you know, push that seed, whatever it is that you're trying to transmute to your children, go ahead and push that through. I'm sure they're not listening, but they're absorbing the information.
And isn't that interesting, you know, because oh my God. I mean, you know, there was a point, because I was a single parent for a long time and it was so hard with two boys really close in age and trying to give them the values, you know, that I knew would serve them best, you know, and just being treated like very not important. And now, you know,
I only giggle because I know I did it to my parents and my children do it to me.
Right. So. Right. No, I didn't realize then how common it was until one parent said, "You're not wasting your breath. Keep going." You know, that is what kept me alive, you know, and that's why I wanted to start with this, because what you're helping parents gain confidence in and be effective at is so valuable. So now we can talk about this, what you've created, the Sankofa Club. And just giving parents, Black parents, the tools and the knowledge and the mindset for helping kids, to nurture kids away from the miseducation that's happening in our schools and grow them in a sense of ownership of what their true heritage is, you know? So tell us, give us your whole spin on that and your whole insights into that. I don't mean spin, I meant insights.
Yeah, no. Well, we just believe one, education is critically important to the advancement of all people. But one's education should be rooted in self-liberation, should be rooted in self-empowerment. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that is done through the lessons that they are given and what is deemed important enough that must be remembered, that must be retained. And if the educational system isn't feeding their own history and culture, at least being a part of the conversation, then it's, you know, it's really damaging. And that's the miseducation element that you're leaning towards. So we just tried to put together a resource that makes it fun and easy for parents to educate their children on Black history and weaving those important lessons into their childhood and their understanding. We just do it through a lot of variety of different ways, but we have our own curriculum, you could say that. Yeah. But it's full of activities and worksheets. And now we've weaved in daily Black history classes taught by teachers. So we're really excited about that. But we find that our parents just really don't know Black history.
Right.
it's not something, it's not like you go through the Western educational system and you come out a scholar of Black history. You know, you find, actually, you start to wonder, where are Black people in history, and had they ever contributed anything of any significance? So that's a total, I totally understand how people come out of particularly the American school system and would have those thoughts. But the damaging part of all of that is, if you don't really see a people's significance or relevance in history, then when you encounter them on the street, you only know the lies and propaganda that is spewed about them. So I think, like, that's the undercurrent of our racial situation here in America, right? Like, the racial reality here in America, but the ugly underbelly is, you know, the educational system and just the misinformation that it's providing about people of African descent.
Undercurrent, and also I would say woven into. I mean, it's not even so under. Once you start realizing that it's in the fabric of our lives. And since I've been paying more attention, which is very recent, actually, I've started to see things that I never saw my whole life, which I'm learning that, and I've been told many times not to feel guilty, not to waste time on the guilt or the shame for my obliviousness. But now that I know, it's time to wake up and notice those biases, notice those knee-jerk reactions as a white woman, to notice those assumptions, that where did they come from and are they valid, you know? And one of them, it hurts me to tell you, Freddie, but the purpose of this podcast is to help other white women like me get these kinds of things up on the surface and then clear them out and replace them with much more valuable insights and ideas. But one of the most painful things is when I see that, you know, that Black kids, the statistics for Black kids academically is really, really low compared to other ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. I made some very, not purposefully, but just, you know, I just jumped to conclusions that, well, I guess they just have too many disadvantages, or I don't know what's going on, but I guess that's just their life. You know, I didn't think about it a lot, which is what happens when something's not relative to you in the immediate, you know. Mm-hmm. But when I see the causes for that, and how would I feel if my group was just always shown in the most lowest of lights, in the most unimpressive, you know? I'm talking too much. This is about you. But I just, you know, I want the listeners to really be able to look at their thoughts and their assumptions and take them out and put them in the light of day. And that's why I wanted to talk to you.
Well, you know, what's even interesting about that is, you know, you talked about, like, you know, the assumptions that you might make once you see data like that. And that data spews into, you know, the crime rates, it spews into the murder rates, it spews into the jail system. So that it's not just isolated to education, but even just speaking educationally, then not only having that feeling, because you're just looking at the evidence, you're just looking at the numbers, not no cause or reasons why something might be, especially might be foreign to an experience that you've had, which is natural. But there's also, like, a litany of false research and historical myths that are perpetuated as truths about the intelligence of the African in the diaspora. These go back. I was just listening to John Henry Clark, and he was just talking about, the most recent book that I can think of is, like, The Bell Curve. Do you remember that book? It was, like, in the 80s it came out, but it's just another book in a long series of so-called high academics and research that proves that, oh, because of the shape of the head of the African, they have a smaller brain. Look at this, all of this pseudoscience that was created to demonize the African in the eyes of the Western world or European or white people, to demonize them in order to justify the subjugation of the people and to put them in the form of chattel slavery of what happened. Because if you could just imagine, you go back a couple of hundred years, okay, you don't have the overt propaganda going on today that we did then, but you mix that with a group of people who are afraid, who are being lied to about the media of what Africans have been trying to do to them. The fact that they're like animal-like anyway, you know, so it's just it was just an overt reason to justify chattel slavery. But this is the remnants of that, and it's still around today. The bell curve, I'm certain, isn't the last book in this particular line. In the mid-80s, that was not defeated. I just don't know what's next, what was next in that particular line of thinking. So I only said that to say that there's more than just, you know, what meets the eye, right, on why you feel that way.
Yes.
So the documentation of the pseudoscience has been in place as well, but it just leads to the media outlets talking about, you know, crime in the area, saying, well, you know, they're just not of average intelligence, so you're going to have to expect these things. Not any of the facts that, you know, the community has been undereducated for hundreds of years, or no education for hundreds of years, and then thrown out into capitalism saying, pull yourself up by your bootstraps with not even shoes on, right? You don't even have any boots or straps. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And then every time it seemed like they got a crumb or something, it was kicked away from them, stepped on, or stolen. We're not going to point to any of those facts or reasons. Like, we're not going to talk about redlining, right? I talked about that last time.
Well, let's keep what you're doing, but then go back to that, because those are the threads that pull it all together. And this is what I have been learning lately, but I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want to.
Yeah, no problem. But so even just growing up white in America, these are the things that you don't have to know. You just assume, right? Because the media and the news and the mainstream, everything has been talking about these things in a context that paints African people in a particular way, right? But the nasty details looks like redlining, looks like government sanctioned redlining, which is segregation, right? So they force a particular set of people, they force Black people to buy in certain redlined areas. And they would have maps literally with red lines drawn around saying, if it's not in this circle, we're not selling anything to African Americans. Now, that was supported by the real estate boards, that was supported by the banks. The banks wouldn't lend to credit-worthy African Americans in the country that wanted to buy outside of these areas. My father was one of them. Yeah. In 1955, he bought his home in Inkster, Michigan, because he was redlined into Inkster, Michigan. He was put in that particular area, and that area was drained of resources. Yeah. This is why the schooling, the academic levels are uneven. The schools, some of our textbooks will be 20 and 30 years old. Yeah. Like, how are you competing with students who, one, got their own textbooks? Like, that was a foreign concept to me growing up. Like, you don't take your textbook home because it's the textbook of the classroom.
Yeah.
So like, just looking at African Americans in a vacuum in 2020, and oh, you had President Obama, everything is equal, is really asinine. But I can see why, if you're not gonna look under the carpet, you know, you're not gonna see any of the dirt.
Right.
And you have to go manually look for it, because America is doing a great job keeping us distracted with nonsense conversations, you know, idiotic arguments among celebrities and politicians or whatever the case may be, but they're keeping us distracted from finding these dirty secrets. Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it. I go on a tirade. You got to pull me back. Just let me know what I
don't want to wanna pull you back, Freddie. Absolutely not. Not going to do that. So you grew up in a redlined neighborhood.
Yes.
So, but then your parents were absolutely adamant that you get a good education. So tell us about that. What did they do for you? What did you get to experience that was probably not so common in your neighborhood?
Yeah. So I was always a really good student. I would have told you, if you talked to me around sixth, seventh, eighth grade, I'm an A student. You know, I'm going to be in the top 3 to 5 of every classroom I'm ever in, right? I had no idea that I was operating in a design small pool, right?
I see.
Yeah, so I had an opportunity. My parents remortgaged their home and sent me to a Catholic school, right? So I attended a private all-male Catholic school. I was actually the only Black person to graduate my high school that year, 1994. Wow, that seems so long ago, right? interesting experience, the early 90s, going through, Reagan's crack era.
Okay.
Living through that, living through the results of that, like him and Ollie North talking on television, about all of this, but the details of that was playing out on the streets of my neighborhood. That's what I grew up with. That's the underfunded, over-policed, over-legislated areas of America, right? Those design red line areas, which are pretty much still in place today. America is still really segregated. I don't know why we try to pretend we're not.
Yeah.
So I grew up in that environment, and then I go to this Catholic school, with basically rich white kids, rich privileged white boys that I love to this day though. So like, I really do. We had a great time. I really enjoy every moment of it, but I got exposed to some things that I only thought happened in movies, on television. I was telling you the story of, I played football there and we would have Unity Night, and Unity Night means the night before the game, the whole team goes to somebody's house. We're going to be together, brotherhood, bonding, getting ready for the game, making sure nobody's going out acting crazy that night because we got a big game in the morning. Coach Tom Mack, if anybody's in Michigan football, high school football, he's a legend there. So we would be in this, all these football players in one house. Now our team had 85 players on it. All the players would be in the basement. And you imagine if you got 85 high school boys, how much food and how much assistance you need that's there. And all of these people are in the same house. I've never seen homes this big in my lifetime.
Yeah.
There's no way Unity Night could ever happen on our property. It can happen on our property. It's not that big.
Yeah,
that many people would not fit comfortably on our property, and we're in the basement. Yeah. That was always blew me away. Yeah. Just those experiences, they were great. So they really kind of lifted the lid off of possibility to me. Because I grew up in a place where a lot of people just don't go outside the 8 to 10 blocks of their neighborhood.
Yeah.
They don't really see any reason why they should. They're just never exposed to nothing bigger or different. That crack era, it was something else. I don't know. But being exposed to that, it looked like I walked into Brewster's Millions. You remember that movie? Like
a little bit, yeah.
Yeah, like I think it was a Richard Pryor movie.
Oh, okay. But anyway,
just one of those. Like I'm in Beverly Hills. I could have been in Beverly Hills. Like whatever, I don't know what you think of when I say Beverly Hills, but when I just think palatial estates, big, just beautiful, just, oh my goodness. It looked like Hollywood to me.
Yeah, which is actually where I did a lot of my growing up.
Wow.
And also in Northern California, really nice areas there too,
Wow.
And not that's anything to, because it's crazy, and you just lift it up a little bit and you just see craziness,
Yes.
Because, what are we really talking about in life that matters, Mm-hmm. It's like what your dad gave you. It's what you're giving the parents and the families in Sankofa Club. So, that's what I want to come back to, because all of that stuff is fun. The bling is fun and all that. But I have seen firsthand how, unless you're filling it up with what really matters, what feeds our hearts and our souls and our spirits and our relationships, we're poor.
Yes.
And so, so let's talk now about maybe some specifics about, like, you're getting parents involved, because that's one of my favorite things. Because I was watching this, there was this whole 1 week of when you were talking with parents every month to get them excited about Sankofa Club. And you were talking about how important it was for them to be getting this education and sharing it with their kids instead of just making sure their kids got it.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's like you got to heal two generations at once because the parental generation is damaged. They don't have any knowledge of self. They don't see themselves in a positive light. And that's really what we're getting to when we're talking about the Sankofa Club. And when I'm talking about history and culture, mm-hmm. I'm talking about seeing yourself in a positive light.
Yeah.
Because that's the base. That's got to be the basis of history, right? So the lens of American or history in America is told through the lens of Europe, right? And it's done for the benefit of your daughters and your sons, exactly. Because your daughters and sons need to see, the great architecture of people that look like them, the great minds, the great scientists, the great doctors, the great lawyers. Of course you can grow up to be a doctor. White people invented medicine, and look at all these great things that we're doing, right? And there's nothing wrong with painting a positive light around your people to inspire your children, right? That's great. The problem is it's at the detriment of our children, because our children are growing up in the same environment, except for they don't see no doctors that look like them. They don't see no lawyers. They don't see no, maybe we need less lawyers, right? But they don't, my lawyer's not listening. But they don't see no engineers, right? So it's hard to be inspired when you don't see yourself reflected in this. So this is why we feel like it's so important to teach the history and the culture to the children, but to do that, we need to educate the parents as well, because we need them to be involved. We need them to bring the information to the child. It's not like you can say, I told you the story when I was a child, right? My dad couldn't sit me down and say, all right, Freddie, we're going to study history. I know how you just love history, right? So we try to make it fun and interesting, but we need the parent to be involved as well, so it could be a joint effort. But if the parent is taking part in our mantra, which is 5 minutes a day keeps the miseducation away, if the parent is involved during those 5 minutes, they're going to learn bite-sized pieces of information and grow as well. And history doesn't have to be like all about all the negative, right? All of the trash, all of the, the horrors of slavery and all of that. Like, there's so many bright spots, so much information that can uplift and inspire. Those are the stories that we need to tell, because it shows the people that what they've done for themselves and that they can do it again.
Of course, of course. So do you want to share some inspiring, maybe, of people that we haven't heard? We've heard about Harriet Tubman, and we've heard about MLK, and, tell us somebody that we haven't heard of that's had an impact on our lives, whatever group we come from,
Wow, that's, I could go so many places. That's interesting.
I'm sure. I'm positive.
Well, I like this story about Mary McLeod Bethune, right? Are you familiar with her?
Heard the name.
Okay, yeah. So this is when I've been doing these Black Fridays things, I've been getting past the surface level, because I've heard the name, and I know about Bethune-Cookman College, which is a HBCU in Florida, which she's one of the founders. Historically Black college and universities, yep. Right? HBCU.
Yep.
So it's a great, her story is wonderful, right? She was like best friends, or some really good friends, I wouldn't say best friends, with Eleanor Roosevelt, right? They were really tight. And through that relationship, she ended up talking with Eleanor's husband, the president, and being part of, I think they called it the Black Council or something, something like that. All right. So I don't want to get too far into that detail, right? But her childhood is really like interesting to me, right? So it takes us to 1875, and you're talking about the Reconstruction period, post Civil War and post Abraham Lincoln, 1865, right? The Emancipation Proclamation.
Right.
1863. But anyway, so she's born in 1875 to parents that were enslaved, right?
Sure.
And they had 17 children. She was 15 of 17 children. Yeah, it's like wow. But when you think about it, people were in that time were having a lot of children in order to work the farms. So, because children wasn't going to school, right? Or at least Black children were. There was no such thing as public education at the time.
Yeah.
And I found it really frightening when I learned that they grew up on the plantation that her parents were enslaved on. Yeah. And there's this story that they tell of Mary when she's going to help her mama go take the clothes up to the big house. So they've been washing for the big house. So it's time to take the clothes up. And this is going to be Mary's first time. And her mom is like, oh, I don't know if she's ready. And her dad says, hey, you know, she's going to have to face it at some point. She might as well go on up there, right? And what that, you know, that it, what is he talking about? That it has been that race relations here in America. It's always been a thing for us. It's for, you know, white Americans, you can ignore it. It doesn't have to impact your life.
Right.
But it's always been a thing for us. And I think about that moment, that it, you know, going up to the big household, she can face it. She's going to have to see it. It's still around today. And that's like what the social justice warriors are fighting for, you know, and police brutality and all of these aggressions that we're still dealing with. But, you know, her dad sends her up there, and being a kid, she sees the kids in the yard. They're out playing. Mom goes in the house, whatever happens. They're just playing around in the yard. And Mary sees a book like on the porch or something, and she picks it up and she goes to look at it. And this little white boy runs up to her and takes the book from her and says, you know, books are for white people. I'd imagine there was something nasty said. I don't know. Maybe I want it to be a violent conflict. But Mary took takeaway from that was the difference between white and Black people must be found in them books. I need to teach myself. I need to figure out how to read. I just found that to be amazing because, you know, it just really sparked something in her. And, you know, her story is she goes on to learn how to read and goes to be educated and founds this college, Bethune-Cookman College. And the whole story is fascinating. But her dad told, when she found out, everyone found out that she wanted to start a school, her dad told her, Mary, don't worry about finding a perfect place and starting a school. She said, find the people that need it and open your school and educate and serve them. I get goosebumps thinking about, you know, what she had to deal with, you know, like at that in the 1800s, like that's just, it's unbelievable. So I feel like stories like that of strength, honor, and dignity, and, you know, will and, you know,
and integrity,
desire,
and
integrity,
service.
You know, I think it's motivational. I think these stories, you know, like I said, they don't all have to be boring and, you know, and how many people, when, you know, like it doesn't have to be that way.
No. It's got to be that. And who were your favorite teachers in schools? The ones that were so excited and turned on by their subject, you know? So absolutely. Yes, it's absolutely necessary.
I laugh because I don't know, totally unrelated, but you made me think about Mr. Sawyer, and he was my seventh grade advanced reading teacher.
Oh, good.
And he had the most monotone voice and personality ever. Like, I swear I'm a C student to this day because of Mr. Sawyer. No. He was actually a really good teacher, a very nice man, but he had the most boring personality. Boy, I tell you.
Kind of like you, only different, Freddie.
Yeah. I like that. Kind of like you, only different.
So, okay. So some parents might have the opportunity to do homeschooling, but you're not even advocating for that, really.
No. Yeah. I don't advocate for homeschooling, but I advocate for being involved in your children's schooling.
Yeah.
You know, whether they go to schools or not. But I just know the reality is everybody just doesn't have the financial means to just stay home and teach their children.
Sure.
You know, and some people, I know people that are just making that sacrifice. And, you know, I know that I'm sure sacrifice is a part of it. But it's just not something that's universal for all the people. So we just try to create resources that assist regardless of if you're homeschooling or, you know, you're schooling in addition to schooling, right? Right. But really a main thread that runs through the organization and through my talks with parents is, and my belief as a parent is, don't be a passenger in your child's education. You have to get in the driver's seat because you can't just think you're going to send your children off to school and they're going to come back educated. And this is for any parent.
Exactly.
Both of my children, young Black boys who are in the, you know, they're supposed to be in the most endangered demographic. They didn't grow up in the rough environment that I grew up in, but I'm in the south suburbs of Chicago, which is like a underserved suburb, if that's a thing, right? Like, okay. It's blue collar. It's not okay. A bad place. I love it. It's no, they don't even know what violence is, right? So
okay.
They have no idea. But they both went through school and have always been advanced. They both graduated at 16. So they're both like really sharp. They went to Illinois Math and Science Academy, which is actually a public school here in Illinois. All children of the state of Illinois are eligible to go there. Uh-huh. You just got a test to get in. So, you know, they're taking the SATs in the eighth grade, like all of this stuff that I was exposed to in Catholic Central when I was in high school, but I didn't have a parental eye. You know, I see encountering these children that had Algebra 2 in the seventh grade.
Yeah.
You know, like when they're getting introduced to that type of information that early, like how powerful that is for their future. But yeah, so I'm an advocate. I just said all that because I'm saying I'm an advocate of being in the driver's seat of your children's education, regardless of whom they are. You can't just expect the school system to educate them. You have to go above and beyond. And that might look like going up to the schools and ensuring that, you know, certain classes are made available or changing out teachers. That meant something me and my wife and I were notorious about in our school system, because you can't just dump my child into a class where the teacher doesn't differentiate. Right. You know, like my children are off the chart. You're just not going to slowly dumb them down. That's not going to happen. So we need another teacher that is all about differentiation. And, you know, so we had no qualms about going up to the school.
Good. And, I'm sure you did it in a way because you both are such positive, bright people. But there was something else I wanted to say. Okay. So I've read on the. I'm a big fan of yours and what you're doing. So I'm on Facebook.
<Thank you. laughs>
I'm not. I wouldn't say stalking, but I'm definitely paying attention.
Doing your research.
You're doing my research. Exactly. And just finding it so inspiring and energizing. You know, to see that. What you're creating, you know, because you get kind of this mind. I mean, I get white people like me can get a very, you know, mindset that there's this passive thing that Black people are just enduring life in America. But the point that I wanted to make was one of the things that I saw was where one parent talked about her son learned something at home through the Sankofa Club and working with his parent. And he went back to school and he said, you're teaching this wrong about my people, you know? Do you want to share any details of stories like that? Because I got out of my seat for that. Yes. Teach the teachers.
Yeah. I have to dig up our files, right? But those stories like that are so inspiring, and it's something that it was so far from our minds when we were kind of starting this. I wasn't thinking about the impact of the children going back into the schools. I remember this story that you're talking about, but I have gotten stories from parents that are saying, "Man, this is so unbelievable." My teenage son has not been interested in school and education in years. It's like, you know, really frustrating. But now I overhear him on the phone speaking about the lessons and the things that they're learning to his friends. So now he's educating his friends about this stuff. And, you know, as they learn about Lewis Latimer's involvement with the filament on the light bulb, which is actually the modern day filament that we use today, the light bulb that worked, right? Thomas Edison created a light bulb, but his didn't work. It would burn and then it would go out. It was the filament from the light bulb that Lewis Latimer created is the one that's the modern day light bulb. And that information got, one of our parents got a hold of that information from a lecture that I was giving, I think during our 5-day challenge that you may be referring to.
Yeah.
But she was telling her children that they were going to have this discussion, you know, 5 minutes a day keeps the miseducation away. So they were getting ready to have their 5 minutes. Of course, the kids aren't thrilled about learning Black history. This was when she was first starting the lectures now, right? But the child being anxious, or just being a child, I think he was like 8 years old or something like that, he knocks over the lamp and knocks over the light bulb, and it falls on the ground and it breaks, shatters. And it was, she said, in that moment, because I had been listening to you, I thought about Lewis Latimer. And instead of being frustrated with my child, we picked up the remnants, you know, and started talking about the filament. And started talking about Lewis Latimer. And then they go look up Lewis Latimer, who's an engineer, who's a creator. Her son gets interested in a particular circuits that Latimer preferred over others. Don't get me into the engineering details. That's not my lane, right? But the son gets turned on by all of this. And now they're at the store buying kits so her son can start to build, you know, the electric currents and understand how light switches work. And now here we have a budding engineer because, you know, the parent has gotten involved with the Sankofa Club. Who knows where the young man is going to go take this source of energy and take it into the future, right? So it's like those types of stories are the feedback from the parents that really just, man, it really inspires us to continue.
And what is, yes, of course. And what is the deeper thread going here? You know, it's like, if you give me facts out there, blah, 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 blah. But when it somehow matters and it touches my life, my experience, my roots, I mean, that's when it hits home and it can light something up in ourselves. And that's what happened with that kid. And I just see what Sankofa Club is doing is lighting those fires and making those connections and creating that ownership of knowledge that matters so that it can be exploded and, you know, brought into the world in new and unique ways that are relevant to the current and future of today's kids.
Yes. Yes. I like to think about, you know, the history and the culture being like it's like the catalyst for getting people to not only appreciate themselves, but then to go out and use their time and talents to serve humanity.
Yeah.
It's so inspirational. I think that's where I was going. History is inspirational, particularly when it's culturally relevant, right? So little white boys and girls don't really understand not growing up in a system that isn't culturally relevant. So like, let's change change the scenario a little bit. Imagine this country was 80% African Americans and it was 15% white people. And then you were going to, your children were going to school learning about the Dogon tribe, learning about Imhotep, learning about the Moors, and only people of African descent. That's it. Every story, every battle, every creation, every victory, every triumph, everything, the media, the movies you've seen, everything was leaning towards the African. And all you would think is, wow, where are we in the pages of history? Exactly. My people had to do something. I need my child to be inspired to be a doctor. How are they ever going to be a doctor if all they ever see is Black doctors? We go to the hospital, the doctors are Black. We go to the clinic, the doctor is Black. We go to Walgreens, the clerk is Black. Everybody is Black. Where is the inspiration for our children? Like, you would start to wonder. Yeah. And the stats and the research shows that unless a child gets, because there's always exceptions to every rule, but when children have more of a cultural connection and understanding to their history and their culture, they perform better in everything. They perform better in schools, they perform better at secondary level, they perform better in colleges, they perform better on the job, they perform better as parents, they perform better in the community, they just perform better. So it's really an important part of every child's education, but it has to, again, it has to be culturally relevant. And, you know, frankly, white people just don't understand it because you were only in that scenario that I gave you for 20 seconds.
Actually, I've just came back a few months ago, just when COVID started. I had just, I was going to be in India for 2 months.
Oh, wow.
And I went there to help a school with some materials that I had created. And then I had to leave early because of the COVID. But that whole time, I was the only white person I saw. And that was the fourth time I've been to India. I've been there many, many times. But this was the first time I'd been there for my educational materials. And I was in a really nice neighborhood, you know, like upper middle class. But the whole month that I was there, I was the only American. I was the only light-skinned person. And when I would try to, I mean, you know, I'm not saying that my experience is yours, but, and I know it's not appropriate to too much talk about my experience, but I just want to say that, now I'm embarrassed that I'm talking about
myself. Don't be embarrassed.
Well, it's just that it was horrible. I will just say that it was so horrible because the things that I would do that I was used to, walking on the street and just eye contact and smiling. Yeah. No, you don't do that. That's my cultural thing. That's not their cultural thing. And the way I dress and the way I walk and my independence and just everything culturally was inappropriate. And, you know, not like I got attacked. I wasn't necessarily in danger, but it was so disorienting. And, and so what I'm thinking is, and sometimes I have talked to, like, especially Black girls, well, they're where their identity starts to sort of melt into the white people that they're with because they don't have an anchor. And do you want to talk about that at all? Because I think that's really something to that you're also helping to have not happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's for the children, that's natural because they're just trying to fit in. You know, they're still just teenagers.
Yeah.
And they still don't know nothing, you know?
Exactly.
even though they don't know that they don't know. Right? And, you know, and social media, and I don't know, even before social media, but just trying to fit in and get along and, you know, to have friends and to be happy is really where they're all at in their minds.
Sure.
And if they're in that environment and that's how all their friends are dressing, that's what they're going to dress like. All their friends got blonde hair. That's what they're going to desire.
Yeah.
And especially if they're not getting fed any cultural appreciation of who they are and who their people are. So just really, there is a, and there's a, one of the ladies that we had on our summit, she talks about the miseducation of our community is that we view proximity to whiteness as a measure of success. And that's so damaging to people because that's deep, right? Like, but how could a people liberate itself and empower itself and depend on itself if the whole value, everything they value is their proximity to whiteness? Mm-hmm. So how close to white people do I live? Like, it's not like a conscious thing, right? But you subconsciously try to aspire to move to the suburbs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Cause you gotta get away. All you know is this environment is not good. Mm-hmm. So you're really just trying to save yourself, right? And if and when you're dealing with children, I mean, they're just really impacted by the media and all of that space. So it's really melting into their minds, but that's why particularly Black people or people who are even just lost, not lost, but inside of a larger culture, they have to work to maintain their identity. Otherwise, it's just going to lead to a bunch of problems, in my opinion.
Well, and not just your opinion, but in your actions, which is one of the huge things that you're bringing. And everybody will win, you know, if we don't have people in our American population that are not valuing themselves and they are valuing themselves, then how much more will they contribute to the big picture of life in America, you know? And they can, everybody can be who they are in their culture, in their individuality. But, but it's just, oh God. Will I get to live to see a world where that is really understood? We don't have to be enemies. Freddie, I've been meaning to ask you, are you the one that told me about Tim Wise?
I'm not. Okay. I know who he is though.
Oh my God. Yeah. All right. Because, you know, that just gets into the whole how this misunderstanding about the importance of putting people down, or the supposedly value, and it's just such a pack of lies. But anyway, okay. So, so Freddie, I wonder, in our previous conversation that got lost into the ether forever, that broke my heart so badly, but we're having another good conversation, which I knew we would. You were talking about at someday you're going to change where you live.
Yes.
And I was wondering, and you can talk to us about that, but then I was wondering, what will you change your name as well?
That's interesting. I haven't considered that, but I should. You know, I think once I get further and further into our roots of who we are as a people, then I think that's just a natural progression, because you definitely want to. I would definitely like to strip the slaveholder's name Taylor from our people. That's why I use Ra on Facebook, right? Because I don't want to use the name. So I guess it's kind of in my mind, but it hasn't been something that's at the forefront. Let me say that. Uh-huh. I'm more concerned with getting out of the country than staying here. And, you know, I've never give up my citizenship. I feel like my people fought for and died over this country in a lot of different ways. So I'll never turn my back on that. Yeah. And hopefully one day America will live up to her promises. But I'm looking forward to getting outside of the bubble of American racism and living somewhere else. I think because I mentioned to you last time, I hate it here. Like I literally hate it here. Yeah. And people shouldn't get mad at me for hating it here. They should get mad at a system that created an environment that makes me want to hate it here. And I find like when I say that, people get angry, you know, they will leave then, this and that. Well, I'm going to leave. Like, that's fine. Don't worry about it, you know? And, you know, frankly, when I leave, you know, I'll establish a company outside of the country and then we'll, you know, do business that way. Because I think Americans have lost sight of what's going on in the world. You know, the world doesn't revolve around America like it used to.
Yeah.
And, you know, when America is going through crisis, the world could not care. Yeah. They really do just go to work and continue business when America is, you know, arguing over what Trump is or isn't doing. Like, I promise you, I was in the UK not long ago, and, you know, it's like the world, no one cares what is going on. Like, but when you're inside the bubble of America, you really think it is the heartbeat of the world. And it isn't. I think that's dangerous for Americans to believe and think that way, because the country won't continue to evolve. It won't continue to evolve to operate in a sane world rather than just trying to weapon up and dominate the world. So I think that the people got to be careful with that American arrogance. Yeah. But I am interested in seeing life outside of America. Particularly, I'm interested in seeing life living with and among people that look just like me, where I can blend in and just be a person and just succeed or fail on my own whims and, you know, have less external pushback because of my skin color.
Oh, or, you know,
the digits on my social security number.
Oh, yeah. Why do you say that about your digits on your security number?
There's like a deep myth. I don't know if it's a myth or not, but I often bring it up though, because it's like a deep belief in the Black community that your social security number is coded and it tells like who you are.
Oh, I never heard that.
Yeah, like there's certain digit combinations and endings that indicate African Americans or Black people. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, I can say it is, like I say, it's probably just a myth, but it's like a real thing in the Black community. We believe.
Yeah.
Well, but that, I mean, but just even that, even if, let's call it a myth, right? But just saying that people would believe it.
Yep.
Because America has done some of the most dastardly things that this planet has ever seen. Yep. To think that your social security number is coded to identify you is not a stretch. We know that zip codes are, you know, people lend based on zip codes for a reason. They know who are in them areas. You know, I'm into data. So, and you can just only imagine where the data analysis is at this date.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's why I said.
No, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. And your reasoning for, you know, thinking, well, that's not impossible. Absolutely, it's not impossible. Yeah. So it's horrible.
Yeah, a lot of people ask me about this, you know, are you going to take the corona vaccine and this and that? I'm thinking, ain't no way in hell I'm taking no vaccines. I have a thing about the flu vaccine. So I'm not like a anti-vaccine vacciner. And I don't want to get into all of that discussion.
Yeah.
But being Black in America, we don't trust it. We don't trust it at all. Yeah. We have no reason to. And like, that's usually my position with white people that you know, ask, that say, well, why don't you have more faith in this and that? We have no reason to. Yeah. Like, we have no reason to trust this country on any level. I'm not talking political parties, because I'm not a Democrat. I'm a registered independent. I wouldn't even identify as an independent, to be honest with you, because I don't think that either of these parties represent the majority of the people. And this is not just Black people. I think we should have more parties because, you know, this is it. Anyway, I know this ain't a political show, so I'm not going to go there.
It's all interesting. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'm just not in either camp. You know, I don't think they represent the people. So that's not where any of my comments ever come from.
Yeah. I hear you. Basically, what I get from you, Freddie, is that you think your own thoughts, and you have the freedom to do that because you grew up with a father who kept you knowing your value culturally and as an individual and with a strong family and a good education. And that's a lot of what you're bringing into the world. I mean,
you know, Nene, you're saying something, and it's something that my wife made me realize the other day. My parents did a phenomenal job of raising us in the middle of the quote unquote hood, like the ghetto. The hood, that's what we call it. The hood, you know, but it's like culturally like a cool thing, but you don't want to be there. You don't want to live there.
Yeah.
But in the middle of that, in the middle of the 80s crack era, the epidemic and all of that, they grew me and my siblings up to really feel like we're royalty. Like, I got a sense of confidence about myself and my being that I shouldn't have growing up in that environment, growing up poor. Like, we grew up poor, but we grew up poor monetarily, but rich, you know, as far as our family and our love and, you know, and instilling confidence in the children. And this is why I wanted to beat that point home, because this is why I feel like instilling Black history and culture into our children is so important, because it does something for the confidence level.
Yeah.
And it's confidence that you need to succeed. Listen, I'm not the brightest person in the world, but I'm confident and I move forward like that. I know if there's a subject that I want to learn, I can pick up a book or 1,700 of them if necessary and learn that. I can get into a class. I'm confident that I can build the skill or gain the insight that I need to succeed in wherever I go. But all of that doesn't come because I can pass standardized testing. That doesn't come because I got rote memorization, or I know my mathematics, right? Or I know how to write in cursive, which is that even useful anymore? But but that comes from just being a confident person and believing in yourself. And I got that belief from my parents. And I think like that is the core of success in America in particular. Like, my wife calls me an average white male. She said, I can't. Yeah, I will explain. she says, you are an average white male if I ain't ever seen one, because this country and this world is ruled by average white men. Like, they, I mean, they're not off the charts intellectually. They're not off the charts physically. They're not off the charts genetically or anything. These are just average people. They're average white men, but they move with confidence, assurance, and a sense of entitlement. And that's the thing. She says, you're an average white male because you always feel so entitled. She was like, you feel entitled to everything. Like, I walk in, like, I'm not meek. You know, I'm not shy. I don't duck my eye. You know, I don't do any of that because I feel entitled. I grew up in the hood, but they instilled a sense of royalty in me. And she, I call it royalty. She says average white male. I don't know, you know.
Well, I caught you off guard, right? I just want to say two things. I mean, I think you have, I love that you have that sense of royalty, but I would say it's not with a sense of arrogance, which would be, you know, and also this term that you use, entitled, you know, that also could have a negative connotation, but I have only noticed such extreme humility but big picture thinking with you. The combination is so beautiful, and also flexibility and open-mindedness, which I usually don't associate with quote unquote royalty or entitled, you know, entitled, this is what I get, this is it. Da, da, da. So I just want to, because those are buzzwords that could not shine right on you. And you are one of the best human beings, you know? So yes, you can have those words. You can have those words, but we gotta make sure we define them uniquely to you. Cause
well, thank you. Thank you for that. Maybe I will change my language.
Well, no,
I appreciate that though. I do. That's kind. You make me sound like the type of person I might like.
Yeah, you're pretty all right, Freddy. You really definitely are.
I think, but I mean, seriously, I believe it. I think I'm funny. There's the real thing though. I think I'm funny, but it's the self-deprecating humor, I think, is cool. You know, I don't know. I try not to take myself too seriously. I'm not that important.
That's a good thing. It's always a good thing to not take ourselves too seriously. I think people who take themselves too seriously get old way too soon.
Yeah. I'm interested in life. And I love to laugh, let me tell you.
me too. All right. I have a question that I really want to hear your thoughts about.
Okay.
Well, there are two questions connected, but I'll give you one and then I'll give you the next one. Is that you probably have a big picture vision for all that you're working on these days. And how does life look for the Black kids in America who've been going through the Sankofa Club for 10 years? Say that they're 5 years, 6 years old now. What are those kids like? And you've given us a pretty good impression, but you know, like when they're 13, 14, 15, 16 years old, what are they like? Compared to kids that haven't had the opportunity somehow or another, didn't hear about Sankofa Club.
You know, they are a lot like Freddie. They are confident, right? They are definitely confident in their being. They carry themselves a different way. But I think here's the key difference. They're problem solvers. They are, they are connected to the history and the culture that makes them connected to the people. And that makes them start to see the world around them differently. And once they see that, then those innate skills and abilities can really kick in and they can solve some of these problems. Because that's what children are, right? Mm-hmm. That's who we are in general. We are curious beings that like to solve issues, right? Mm-hmm. Like we tend to enjoy that, particularly children. And if children see something wrong in the world, you know, they'll drop everything, including a piggy bank to grab their coins, you know, to go out and try to assist. Like we've seen that time and time again. But in 10 years, you know, I see our young Sankofa Club kids turn teens, being problem solvers in their own individual worlds, and then hopefully trying to solve the problems of the greater human condition.
I love that. One of my things that I just have really a terrible deficit of patience for is the victim mentality. You know, so I love that you're emphasizing on that, that just to help these kids grow into problem solvers and probably critical thinkers too.
Yeah. Oh man, the best gift you can give a child is the gift of critical thinking.
Yeah.
That's all you really need. Like, man, I love books, and I'm an educated person, and I will forever educate myself.
Yeah.
But you know, you could burn every library, not every school, you know, and every system out there, you know, as long as our people still got the gift of critical thinking, we'll put it back together again.
Yep.
So that is still the key skill of life.
It is. It is. And it's, if I had to point to one thing that has put our country currently in such horrible shape, is that lack of critical thinking and analysis that doesn't question what the heck? What?
Yes. What and why? Which, oh my goodness.
You know,
well, don't get me started on politics. Have you noticed I always try to steer clear of politics? Because this man, I just don't understand.
But it's just mucking up our lives so bad. I'd like to steer clear of it too. But you know what? It's been there all along underneath everything. So, you know, in a way, this is an amazing time if we can just not have that victim mentality and just say, okay, how do we, what can we do? You know, one vote, one person really matters. Okay, I'm not going to talk on that too much more. But, you know, it is how things change, is that vote. So, and people have to think and analyze and have their own thoughts and have that problem-solving mentality. So again, I applaud what you're bringing, so that black kids and black families can move forward. So,
well, you know, they say, I know you got a question, but they say, you know, if you want to change the future, you got to educate the children.
Of course.
So, you know, this is my effort to change the world. So we're going to pour into the children, and you was asking about like the vision, you know. I definitely got a short-term vision of educating a million families. But, you know, eventually we want to move into the tens of millions globally. I want to start teaching Sankofa Club lessons under different languages. That's something that we're getting into. We want to recruit linguists that speak different African languages. Like, I'm from the Yoruba tribe, so Yoruba. So I'm still trying to get the dialect. I don't even have the dialect, right? Like, but I'm excited to learn. But like, I want to start not only teaching those languages to English speaking children, but even vice versa, so that they can start to have a communication link, and maybe do like a pen pal type of thing around the world. So I don't know. I'm very excited. We could do a whole show on ideas I have.
Oh boy. Well, you know me, I'm going to keep chasing you down. But okay. So, oh shoot. That started another question for me.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Oh no. Okay. It's gone for now, but it'll come back.
It'll come back.
So, the parents, like, okay, we started out talking about your dad, and he just did what he knew was right. And he wasn't getting any positive feedback, and he wasn't getting any much cooperation from you and your siblings. But he just kept on because he knew what was right. And you're getting positive feedback, and you're getting, but what do you see for these parents now that are starting, and what do you see the parents of these kids in 10, 12 years? Who are they? What kind of lives are they living? What kind of letters are they writing to their kids who've been through Sankofa Club?
Yeah, well, they are just proud at the children that their young people are becoming, right? But even beyond that, the scales are falling from their eyes, because if they've been keeping up for the 10 years, the lessons that they've learned over the years, or the lessons that their children have brought to them, is continuously poured into them. So I think that, you know, just that pride, because they start to understand deeper and deeper, and they can see the connections themselves. I think they become vastly more aware of what's going on. And I think they're getting involved as well. So I think it moves from, because a lot of Black people are passive about, you know, engaging our community, right? So it's just like, hey, you know, I got mine, they better get theirs, and that type of activity. But when you start to learn about your history and your culture, you start to embrace your people a bit more. So I think there's more active involvement inside of the community. Brandy Woods spoke to our group during our summit, and she started talking about being stakeholders in the community, like, yeah, or stakeholders in the schools. Like, yeah, your children might have matriculated through the schools and they're graduated. And yeah, you pay taxes, but you don't got no kids going to the schools, but you got kids going to the schools. They're just not your kids. You're a stakeholder in the community. These are all of our children. So we still have to have an involvement in there. So she says, once your children have matriculated through the schools, then that gives you more time to be free to go up to the schools and volunteer and engage other people's children, right? And to give back that way. So I think that we'll see involvement pick up as far as activity on that level. I am a 10-year veteran of the PTA. So I'm always pushing parents to go get involved inside the PTA. So I would hope that that ticks up, but just overall more involvement and then more excitement and pride because of what their babies are doing.
See, you always expand everything, Freddie, in the most healthy and right way. I love that. That is so right and so real. And so, I mean, it makes, as soon as you say it, it's like, oh, of course.
Yeah. Now I said it, but it wasn't until I heard Brandy Woods. She owns like a string of daycares, right? But until she said it, I was like, oh my God. I've been talking to my wife like, yeah, it's time for us to go get back into schools. Like, yeah. Now we really got time, yeah. You know, like to be there and to just help. And oh, you need to go on a field trip. And oh, we need extra volunteers to read to the kids. Like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I'm going to read from the Sankofa Club, right? Like,
yeah,
it's just so much more opportunity. So when she said it, it was, I keep repeating it because it was really a good light bulb moment for me.
Fabulous.
Because like, and look, let me keep expanding, right?
Yeah.
Really, if we want to see a change in the world, and this is for all parents, this is or all adults, all yeah. people, then we got to be the change we want to see. So wouldn't it be great if, you know, the elders were going into the schools and engaging with the children, you know, while they're still listening and talking to you, you're still so impressionable. Yeah. And maybe that child that you gravitate towards got shitty parents. Excuse me cussing, right? But you know, maybe they got shitty parents, right? And yeah. then that interaction with you might just be the seed that child needs to get through their situation so that they can get out of that house and really start to blossom. Like, you really just don't know the impact that you have on people. If I could take it further, I got a story when I went to Catholic Central, right? And I was going to school with these rich white boys. I had my first job. Little story about Freddie Taylor. He only had two jobs in his life, right? Like, so I had one job in high school and one job in college, right? Uh-huh. I've been an entrepreneur ever since. Okay. But I'm an entrepreneur because of this first job. I worked in the Process Development Corporation. I worked in the accounting department over the summer before I went to college with Mr. Pongers. Mr. Pongers is the owner. He was one of my friend's dads on the football team. And in that accounting department, I used to separate the money, right? Checks and bills and all this stuff, inputting. And I was just mesmerized by the size of the checks. And I go in his office one day, I'm like, Mr. Pongers. I'm like, oh my God, how can I do this? How can I have this type of money, right? And he was like, he said, Freddie, nobody's ever gonna pay you that type of money. You gotta build something of value and earn it. And that stuck with me. And a couple of weeks ago, I got an opportunity to tell Joe, Mr. Pongers' son, please pass along my thanks. I told him that story and Joe had no idea. Mr. Pongers didn't either. But the point is, you never know who life you're touching. Yeah. And that summer with Mr. Pongers made all the difference in my world because I didn't know any entrepreneurs. Yeah. The only entrepreneurs I knew were drug dealers. And everybody in my family was hardworking, go to work, blue collar, go to work, go to the military, get a job, retire. That's life.
Yeah.
And, you know, he brought me not even into the business, into the accounting department. So I got to see the money. I've never been the same.
Oh, what a great story. Wow. Wow. What are your sons entrepreneurs? What are they up to?
They work inside my company now. But yeah, they both want to be entrepreneurs. My oldest more so than my youngest. My youngest is still finding himself a bit.
Uh-huh.
He just graduated high school, but he's in the illustration.
Uh-huh.
So he he talks about either just working as an illustrator or opening up his own illustration firm. So, you know, but he works in the customer service department of my company, and he is one of our rock stars. So I love him to pieces, but he's taking a gap year. We are COVID petrified. So I know a lot of people think it's fake. I don't know. We're not in that camp. So he graduated and we're doing a gap year. I've always wanted him to do a gap year, but I never envisioned it this way. I wanted him to travel the world, you know. Wanted him to go experience some things. But we're just doing it a little bit differently right now. We're being safe first.
Good. I know people that have been very, 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 very sick with that. I don't know anybody who's died with it, but it's, I think it's real. And you know what? This whole time of recalibration is pretty fascinating what it's bringing up. So, yeah, I mean, you know, life in the big picture is knows how to adjust itself, you know, and if we can be in tune with that, great. If we're going to fight it, then we shall see who comes out on top of that battle.
we're going to figure it out.
All right. Well, I want to talk to you at some point about your future plans, because I think that it's very enlivening for all of us to have get to have share in your vision and see what's going on, because otherwise we're just getting all the negative news and that's not okay.
Yeah. Well, I'll come back and share anytime. I would say give me to the new year, because we got our new initiatives down and we're really pushing forward to make them happen. I think in the next 3 to 6 months we'll look like a different company.
Very cool. And I have some ideas I want to share with you too, but we'll just, that'll Please be another do. Conversation. Absolutely.
Yes.
All right, Freddie. Thank you. With all my heart. Say hello to your father and tell him I said thank you for him persevering and taking such good care of you kids and the sacrifices he and your mom made. They're affecting all of us, you know? It's real.
Yeah. There are some special people. I appreciate them.
Clearly, clearly. All right, Freddie. All my very, very best to you.
Thank you. Same to you. Appreciate y'all listening to me.
Oh, Freddie. All right. We'll be in touch.
All righty. Bye-bye. Okay.
Bye.
As white people, we have so much to learn about Black people's lives and experiences. And a lot of what we need to be learning and understanding and absorbing is difficult, it's uncomfortable, painful. You don't really need me to tell you that. It's common knowledge, and it's probably a big part of why you're sharing some of your learning journey with me. The thing is, we also need to learn to try to understand and to absorb Black people's strengths, their values, their energy, and their intelligence, which is why I was so grateful that Freddie agreed to share his thoughts with us. And I highly recommend that you go to his website, urbanintellectuals.com, to get a broader sense of his activities and contributions, and the wider circle of his associates as well. We all need inspiration to remain energized and hopeful. So thank you, Freddie Taylor. And thank you, listeners. If you haven't already, please tell your friends about this podcast and subscribe. I promise you, this podcast is just going to become more and more worthwhile. Thank you for being here. Till next time.